Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Before My Time. I am your host, Gelsey Laurie, and we are joined, as always, with Matt Kelly to talk about our top five favorite black and white movies. Let's see what they are.
We're here to entertain you. We'll sing your songs for good times, the best times. You can't go wrong. We'll two-step, a new step. It won't be long. When the Dixielands are playing, soon you'll be swaying. So come on, sing along.
Gelsey, this may have been, I know we say this at the start of almost every top five episode, but I, for me personally, as a hardcore cinephile, this was such
a... I don't like that word. That sounds too close to pedophile. I don't like it.
I know, but that's the word. That's the word. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, the word people. Change it.
Like, because it was, you know, when you're doing like top five Beach Boys songs, there's a lot, but it's a very condensed pot. You know what I mean?
You can only pick like, from the Beach Boys. I know. I almost was going to text you and say, should we do like a time frame? But I didn't. But
I ended up putting them in my honorable mentions, but there were definitely two films that I wrote down that were well past when black and white movies were still.
Me too. And I know one of them is we have the same, but I put an honorable. I was like, no, this technically should be on my top five, but I'm going to make that rule for myself that like.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I am glad that without texting each other, we both concluded that Young Frankenstein couldn't be in the
convention. It's exactly the one. I knew. I was like, we're both going to pick Young Frankenstein. I was like, I feel like that's a cop out though, because in the 70s, it's just like we're well beyond black and white movies. That's
yeah,
not what
I think.
Meant.
I think we should say black and white representing an era to a certain point. Like,
yeah, because I kind of have one that kind of does that. That like technically we had color, but anyways, we'll get into that. But
yeah, all right. Yeah. Well, you pick this topic. I'll let you go first.
Okay. Let's see. I'm not going to lie. I really have no specific order because all of my top five, they just are top five, but I would say they all in some way kind of are equal in my mind. Again, and I think we discussed this off the air, but these aren't necessarily what we think cinematically is the top five should be an AFI's top five, you know, so it's kind of more personal at this point, just like all the songs, like what is our favorite? Just want to put that out there because I know there's going to be a lot of movies that people are like, are you fucking nuts? But I am, if you didn't know that. Yes, yeah. I am.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome. You know what? I'm going to just start with this one, I think. So I'm going to start with All About Eve, 1950.
Ooh,
this is Betty Davis. It's a dramatic film. I had to put on – I kind of went by some of my actresses that I was like, I knew – I love Betty Davis. I've listened to her book called The Lonely Life, really good autobiography. And kind of sad, you know, it's about the lonely life. But yeah. She is by far one of the best dramatic actresses ever, period. Not even of that era. And I want to say this is the movie I've seen the most of hers and that had the biggest impact on me. And it's, she's a little older because obviously Bette Davis was acting, you know, into the 30s or starting then, and she was so young. But I like her more as that a little bit older, refined, bitter woman. I think she plays that part so well and grew into that more so than when she was younger. This is, yes, like I said, 1950 American drama film written and directed by Joseph Mankiewicz. We'll say that's right. Definitely Jewish. And produced by Daryl Zanuck, which Daryl Zanuck has produced hundreds. I mean, I could go through his list. It's crazy. But it stars Bette Davis as Margot Channing, a highly regarded but aging Broadway star, and Anne Baxter as Eve Harrington, an ambitious young fan who maneuvers herself into Channing's life, ultimately threatening Channing's career and personal relationships. So it's kind of about being this has-been star and the new up-and-coming coming in. And Marilyn Monroe is actually in this movie. She has a smaller role in it, but it's one of her earlier kind of cameos. And it, like I said, there's a monologue she has at the end in the taxi cab about being a woman. She's like, that's the thing about being a woman. Like, your career could be great and this, that, but at the end of the day, you're only seen as one thing. You're only a woman. You're a man's wife. You're this, that. And I'll have to find it and send it to you because it's brilliant. But probably the most famous line from this film, and probably one of the most famous lines in movies, period, is "Fasten your seatbelts. It's gonna be a bumpy ride."
Yeah, no, it's a great movie. Bette Davis did make it onto my top five. I will throw that there was an honorable mention for a Bette Davis movie on my list, which was "Whatever Happened to Baby Jane" from 1962, that kickstarted. A subgenre referred to as the psycho bitty subgenre of finding these actresses from way back when and putting them in like more exploitative, almost borderline horror movie type roles. But yeah, Bette Davis is phenomenal. I mean, her eyes are so pretty. There's songs about it.
She's got Bette Davis eyes. Actually, that kind of revived Bette Davis's career in a way. Or she talks about it in her book, how that, you know, it had been a decade or two that now she's just this old star. And when that came out, people were like, you're Bette Davis? Like, yeah, it was kind of a cool little.
She has, I believe she's the one that has this quote. I can never remember who passed away first, but obviously her and Joan Crawford. Yes, Joan Crawford. Infamously disliked each other. And I forget which one died. I'm going to say for the sake of this story that it was Joan that died first. And then Bette Davis, when asked for a comment about it, said, "My mother told me never to say anything bad about the dead, only the good. Joan Crawford's dead. That's good."
I would say that sounds like a Bette. I don't know. I could see either of them saying that. I'm surprised I haven't watched it yet, but I need to watch Feud.
I still haven't watched Feud either, which is literally about the making of what, whatever happened.
Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon playing them, and they're both brilliant actresses as well. So I do need to watch.
There's no way it's not a good watch. There's like I refuse to believe that it's not. I'm going to go in the complete opposite direction of All About Eve. When I was in college and I started taking a film class, I got really sucked in to this comedy troupe, and I now own every movie that they've ever made, and that's the Marx Brothers, and I had to go with what I think is their best film, Duck Soup.
I knew it. I was like, it better be Duck Soup. I was just thinking, I was going to say it.
Duck Soup is so smart. Oh, it's so fun. I mean, and let me say that, like, picking a best Marx Brothers film isn't easy because, like, every one of those movies has, like, classic scenes. I want to say it's Night at the Opera that has like the scene where it's like 10 people in a very tiny closet. Like, they do a lot of really impressive physical bits. We really do need to do a Marx Brothers episode in the future.
We do,
like,
yeah.
But the big thing with that one is probably the mirror gag. I would say that's probably the most famous Marx Brothers moment, especially in Duck Soup, in which Harpo is dressed like Groucho, breaks a mirror, revealing a room on the other side, and when Groucho comes to investigate, he pretends to be Groucho's reflection in the mirror.
Yes.
And they do like a 4-minute completely inside, like, I don't know why there's no, I don't know if the audio got lost or whatever, but when you watch like the DVD versions of it, there's no audio suddenly. Like, it's like complete silence of them doing this, like, waving the hands at the same time, like doing a weird jump and skip move in front. Like, it's just, it's a brilliant comedic beat. And it's super short. That movie's like 64 minutes or something. Like, it's it barely constitutes a feature length film, but it is so funny, so charming. I love the Marx Brothers, but this is, it's the first one I watched, and they never hit the highs of Duck Soup, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Even with how much I like their other films.
I do love 1938 Room Service, the Marx Brothers.
Room Service, which is fun.
Ironically, I'll let this be a transition for me to my next one, has a very young Lucille Ball in that movie as the lead lady. As a pretty, even though it's a comedic movie, obviously, she's not a comedian in it. She's just kind of the leading lady.
Well, especially 1938, it was like you weren't allowed to be a funny woman still.
Exactly. And so that, I was like, oh, I was curious if it was going to be that, because I was like, funny enough, I have a movie that Lucille Ball is also in as a very small role in 1936, and this is on my top five, Follow the Fleet. And this
I've never
is
even
my
heard of this one.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movie that I put on there. And that was very difficult for me to pick which one. I'm not going to say I have a favorite. I love them all for different reasons. But Follow the Fleet was one that I've probably seen the most. And it just hit me when I did watch it that I was like, I love this movie. And there's a very young Lucille Ball in that as well. Fun fact, though, Lucille Ball, who I listened to her autobiography as well, and I'm currently reading Ginger's, but Ginger Rogers' mother was almost like a dead mother for a lot of these women in the entertainment world. She really helped advocate for Ginger and got her career on the roll, but she kind of took in some girls that were all in the same contracts. I forget what studio they were under, you know, because you'd be contracted and then kind of just in your acting classes and trying to get the next role. And Lucille Ball owes a lot of her career to Ginger Rogers' mother for taking her in at certain points in her life and guiding her and molding her. Because, you know, Lucille Ball is funny. You know, we know her as Lucy and I Love Lucy and one of the best female comedians. That is not what her career started as. And that's not what she was going for originally. She was going for the same thing Ginger was, a serious starlet actress. And yeah. Ginger Rogers even talks about how, you know, her career is looked back on and everyone goes, Fred and Ginger. Oh, she's the girl with Fred. She's a dancer. And she's like, I've had more movies than I have with Fred that are not with him and more dramatic roles. She's a brilliant actress as well, but you know, they kind of get stuck in. I mean, Lucille Ball will always be Lucy, the silly, like that is who she is. And, but yeah, so I thought that was really cool that Ginger Rogers' mother had such a big impact on Lucille Ball's career. But Follow the Fleet is 1936, like I said, a musical comedy. And it has one of the most, it's Irving Berlin. We all know how I feel about Irving Berlin. Fucking love him. I'm not going to go. It kind of comes into how you always talk about these musicals where you're like, the plot kind of sucks and it's kind of not. But it's about some seamen who get shore leave. Are they in New York City? What do I feel like? Or that's
It's not that the plot sucks. I feel like it's just they reuse a lot of plot just to get you to like, here's the cool dance number in this version of this storyline that you've already seen.
Kind of, yeah. And some of them like have a fun, you know, this has a fun intertwined typical. The plot is what it is. I'm not even really going to go into it, but some of the more famous songs that Irving Berlin has in this is Let Yourself Go, Let Yourself Go, Relax and Let Yourself. Ginger Rogers singing that is just the cutest. She has this cute little captain's sailor hat on. And,
I'm definitely going to have to watch this.
She's just the most charming, sweet thing ever. I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket, which we also get in Holiday Inn. Do we get that in Easter Parade as well? I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. And then the most famous probably top Fred and Ginger numbers of all times is Let's Face the Music and Dance. And this is, they're in a show and Let's Face the Music and Dance. You know, Fred sings first, which they do a lot. He'll sing to her. And then they have this big dance number, which the song is so sweet. The lyrics are, you know, Let's Face the Music and Dance or whatever. It's kind of very off key, but it's a very sweet lyric into a metaphor of life, you know, it obviously. But in this number, they did so many takes of this dance and she had this giant, I mean, always a beautiful ball gowns and her sleeves were huge and it was this really heavy beaded dress. And they took, I forget how many takes they ended up actually making. It was, I'm just seeing if I can like see a quick number here, but it doesn't look like it. a lot of takes, and the take they ended up using is one where it's a continuous shot for 2 minutes and 50 seconds. There we go. And during the first take, Roger's dress, which was heavily weighted as to be achieve a controlled swinging action, hit a stare in the face midway through the routine. And that is actually the take that they used. And so I have watched it, and you can see when it just like knocks him out, but it was the best take they had. And he keeps going because, yeah, of course, he's a professional. So I do love that dance. It's one of the most beautiful Fred and Ginger dances. And that's, there also is one of my favorite numbers in this is they're kind of working on a show on a boat, and Fred's gets Ginger up and he's like, okay, let's like, just follow me. Let's see if we can like work a routine out. And he does a dance and she kind of follows, but is mocking him, and he'll change to the next dance move. And she keeps doing the same dance move as before and will run into him. And it's just a brilliant, she ends up falling like hard on her ass. She goes flying. Like I would say like stunt woman flying. It's impressive. And I just love it. So anyways, yeah.
I love that we're just like flip flopping between light and dark as each person.
Yeah, that's, I mean, black and white. It's like how, that's how, yeah, I kind of had to get a little.
You
bit
went with something lighthearted, and now I'm about to bring us down to the cold, harsh realities of what happened to many silent film stars with one of the best noir movies ever made, Sunset Boulevard by Billy Wilder. Absolutely love this movie. This was another one that I remember watching in that college film course and then immediately buying a DVD, and I would watch it constantly because, I mean, first of all, groundbreaking to start a movie already letting us know that our main character is dead. You know, the movie opens with the narrator's corpse floating in a pool being like, I bet you're wondering how I got here. And then we go through this dark,
very
twisted
Great Gatsby
tale. Yeah, seriously. Very twisted tale. And it, I mean, we were talking about with All About Eve, some of the, All About Eve has that famous film line. This obviously has, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille.
Yeah, I always say that.
Like, it's just so, it's so good. It's so sad. It's not a horror movie, but it uses a lot of the, like, German expressionism camera tricks to just put you in a state of unease every time that they're walking around this big empty manor and you know that things are going to go badly by the end because you know that he's going to be dead by the end of the movie. Yeah. And it's so smart. Literally any Billy Wilder movie could just make out that, like, even just doing a top five Billy Wilder list would be very difficult because the man has made
list.
So many. Yeah. You didn't put him at all on your list?
I said, don't worry, he did make my list. Of course
he
made
did
my
make
list.
Your list.
Of course.
I was going to say, I think I might have two Billy Wilder films on my list.
I feel like you're going to be like, I feel like the next couple of you, maybe this one you won't be able to call, but okay, so I'm gonna do this for the next third because I feel like this is a very, very obvious pick. And you might have it too, but I'm going to go with 1942 Casablanca.
You
have it on your list, right?
I actually had it in the same spot as you, as my number three.
Oh, interesting. Like, mine are kind of no reason, no rhyme, but I just felt like it was, I didn't want to put it as number one. I don't know why, just because
I think it's the same reason I didn't put it as number one. I'm like, everybody puts that as the number one best
movie. It's not my number one as much
no.
as I love it. It's my number one, you know. But this one, it's undeniable. Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman.
I mean, we have a whole episode about it.
I was just
going to
say,
hey guys,
55.
Check out our episode.
Honestly, check out episode 55. We do. I really enjoyed that episode. Sometimes I fumble and you're probably listening going, Kelsey, get your shit together. This is like the worst episode. I really like our Casablanca episode. I have a lot of really cool insight of the making of it. And it was a really interesting film. They kind of were writing it as they went, which did not happen.
The movie is so good, and the fact that it was literally being assembled as it was being shot, it makes it all the more impressive how tight the script is. And I think we talked about that on that episode, but like also very funny. It's a very
funny movie. It has great, and I feel like that's like the best if you're going to have an extremely dramatic film. Shakespeare did it all the time. You have that comedic relief. You have to, because it's just too fucking depressing. And Casablanca has a really nice use of that kind of little, what would you call it? Waves. I'm doing motions.
Yeah. Flames
on the side of my face. Like, that's how I feel right now. You know what I'm trying to say. So, yeah, we're not going to go too far into Casablanca.
Because we have a whole hour of it that y'all can listen to.
Check it out. I do highly recommend that one. And he is.
All right, well, then you get to dive right into number two, because that was my number three.
Great. Well, number two. Okay. This is probably one of the most influential films on me. I saw it when I was, I think, 15 years old, and this is what got me into film noir and this. So it's 1933 Babyface, starring Barbara Stanwyck.
Yes.
And this is a pre-code drama film. And if you don't know what pre-code is, we have an entire episode on pre-code films, episode number 17. Look at me, Matt.
These top five episodes are always really good for us to push people to other episodes of the show.
I do really like
it's like when you're on YouTube and it's like, if you like this video, maybe we
should check out our others. It is. Well, in pre-code era, I'll just do like a really quick, it's basically before the Hays Codes came out, which is, we have it a little bit today in our rating system, PG, G, rated R, PG-13. That didn't exist. And so back in like the late 20s when the talkies came out into most of the 30s, because they didn't really push it for a while, there was no
It was like the law. Wild West a little bit.
It was
bit.
The Wild West of films. And there's a lot of shit you think, ooh, they're modest, they're prude, it's the 30s, it's all this. Who knows? There's lots of
watch
like,
a Tarzan movie from the late 20s, early 30s. Like,
Tarzan was one that I definitely was like, what year is this? Can they?
But yeah, there's so much nudity in it.
It is. It's so much nudity. It's great. I love it. That's why I watch HBO. but this movie is an awesome, like, it was marketed with the tagline, she had it and made it pay. And it's this real, I remember I was watching Turner Classic Movies is when I first saw it, and they were advertising, like, this is going to be on later. And the preview for this movie was this real wah, 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 wah. Men took advantage of her wah, 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 and now she was gonna get what she wants, like, and I was like, I have to see this movie. And this is my first Barbara Stanwyck, who now is one of my all-time favorites, like, between her and Betty Davis, like, I can't honestly decide who's my favorite, probably Betty, but I just love Barbara. Someone on Instagram told me that I remind them of her. This man that follows me or this that was like, you look like Barbara Stanwyck, and I was like, thank you.
I'm actually talking to a ghost right now because you died immediately.
I died immediately. I was like, "What, Barbara?" But she has that same thing that Betty does on screen, where they're not the most beautiful women of Hollywood. They're really not. But you can't. That's why they had these roles of these strong femme fatale. They're definitely the ones that killed somebody and they're not sorry. And oh, they're so good. And so it makes them beautiful and sexy and independent. And that's why they're the women of film noir. And so this movie's a super, I would recommend just watching it. It is a bit long, but it's really amazing for its time, where she plays Lily Powers. It's a very young, attractive woman, and kind of sleeps her way to the top. And then once she actually finds love, she loses it because she realizes that's, you know, it's one of those movies. And it was, I think it was their response to Redheaded Woman was this is a Warner Brothers film, and it was the answer to MGM's Redheaded Woman, which was 1932, starring Jean Harlow, which kind of had a very pre-code film with a similar theme of women getting what they want. This is actually really interesting, though, because the production head, Daryl Zanuck, who I talked about earlier, wrote the treatment for the film and sold it to Warner Brothers for $1. The Great Depression was having a devastating effect on the film industry at the time, and many studio personnel were voluntarily taking salary cuts to help. Zanuck did not need the money because he was drawing a weekly salary of $3,500, which at that time was a lot. He later left Warner Brothers and became the head of 20th Century Fox. So he kind of did this on a, you know, like, voluntary-ish, but this, that. This was only shot in 18 days, and it cost $187,000 to make. And, yeah, it's just, it uses St. Louis Blues as kind of the main song they use with the na, 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 na. And it's just so good. There's a great scene. One of my favorite scenes is her explaining to someone. She's tearing up, you know. She's like, men, they've taken what they wanted from me, and now I'm going to get what I want to get to the top. Just real great hysterical rants that are my favorite. I definitely highly recommend this film.
All right. So my number two, I went with a horror movie. I'm going to make an assumption. I think I know what your number one is, and I'm going to assume it's not a horror movie, so I can say where my thought process was. So So if I'm being a person who's putting a horror movie in there because it's a work of art and it's a masterpiece and it's everything that everyone says about it, then it would be Psycho. It would be Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. It's an incredible movie. But if I'm going with what is the black and white horror movie that I have watched more than any other that I have just loved so much, it's the original Creature from the Black Lagoon. I have always loved the creature. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with the look of the creature. It was probably one of the earliest horror movies I ever watched was my grandfather's VHS tape of Creature from the Black Lagoon. And it's got some of the most beautiful underwater cinematography in there. We've done two of the Universal monsters. We really should try to get the other three big culprits knocked out. I mean, October's quickly approaching, honestly.
Don't say that. I don't want summer to go that fast. I'm enjoying my best summer life.
We're nearing the beautiful, lovely fall, my favorite season.
No, it's been so gloomy. No, summer's going to last long. Halloween, but I guarantee you, mark my words, I'll be in a bikini at Halloween. That's going to be that kind of season.
Well, you also live in a place where that's actually probably more acceptable. But yes, no, Creature from the Black Lagoon, gorgeous movie. The creature design's so nice. It's one of the first times that I feel like they may... Oh, no, that's not true. Frankenstein, I think, fell into that same category, too. But we're
Sympathy
really getting
the
into...
Monster.
Yeah, like the monster is almost as much of a victim as any person that's harmed by the monster because the creature's just doing its thing, living and existing, and then a bunch of assholes try to capture him, and then he tries to fight for survival at that point. He does kill some people along the way, but still,
whoops.
You know, you got to crack a few eggs. So, Kelsey, how about you tell us why Some Like It Hot is your number one on the list?
I knew you. I was like, you know what it is. Like, and if you are an avid listener of this podcast and you've been with us since, God, the episode three was Some Like It Hot. I haven't listened to that. God, how long ago was that?
That was with Meg.
A year and a half
ago? That was
ago?
Our first guess as well.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I was still very in my concussion recovery, and I remember listening back on that episode going, I don't remember really recording this. I know I was staying at my friend's place. It's so weird. But anyways, 1959, Some Like It Hot. And it's funny, we said at the beginning of this that we were like, oh, we can't do Young Frankenstein because colored movies were accessible and they did it as a novelty. That is exactly what they did with Some Like It Hot. This is 1959. Black and white movies were not done anymore. They actually fought to not make this a black and white movie. But Billy Wilder was like, this has to be a black. Here's my Billy Wilder. This has to be black and white. It's the only way that aesthetically it'll make it all work. And he was 1,000% right. So even though I said, oh, we can't do that, I totally chose that. And I said, there's no rhyme or reason to my order. I lied. This is absolutely 1,000% my number one. This is one of my top three all-time favorite films of all time.
This is one of your favorite movies ever,
period.
ever made.
Like, screw color or black and white. It just is. Again, if you want to like really, really, really deep dive into it, go into episode three. I've got all the information, but it is a Marilyn Monroe film, a Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. And it is a classic 1920s gangster film where Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon are musicians that see what is supposed to be equivalent to St. Valentine's Massacre. So they're in Chicago. They see this huge gangster shooting. They escape. And so now the gangsters are off after them. They have to hide out from the mob. And they pose as women in an all-women's band to get a free ride to Florida. Marilyn Monroe is a singer of that. So, of course, Tony Curtis falls in love with her. And then while they're in Florida, pretends to be a millionaire and woo her, but then his side still jumping back and forth being her female co-bandmate. And it's Jack Lemmon's performance. Like, he would be the comedic relief we're talking about. But Jack Lemmon is brilliant in this movie. It's just my favorite movie of all times. Like, yeah.
I was going to
say,
I honestly,
just watch it.
I know you're saying
you
top
it.
Three, but I genuinely think this is your number one film.
I do think
time.
This might be my favorite movie of all times. I've watched it. So this was my first Marilyn Monroe movie I ever saw. Yeah. And I think I talk about it in the episode. I was doing a dance recital for my mom, and she had me doing a solo to Diamonds Are Girls' Best Friend. My father, being the father he is, an amazing man. Hi, Dad. was like, you have to see this movie. He got it wrong. He didn't realize that was from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. He rented some like It Hot and was wrong, but we both were like, this is the best movie. And I was probably 6 years old. Yeah. And I think it's been one of my favorite movies, if not then my favorite movie ever since.
This is another one that I've sung the praises of as one of my favorite movies of all time. I always talk about this with a little bit of sadness because it's a little bit of a sad movie. Who am I kidding? But it's a movie that I remember watching after my grandfather had already passed away. And it had been, you know, this wasn't like I watched it a few months after. It had been a good amount of years. But I remember watching it and feeling like an unspoken connection back to my grandfather with it. It's a Christmas classic. Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. It's just such a pretty movie. And I think that people misconstrue it a lot of the times. I hear a lot of people be like, oh, that's a depressing movie about a guy who wants to kill himself. And I'm like, yes, if you boil it down to the bare essentials, that's what it is. What I see it as is a beautiful story of how much our lives impact the people around us, even if we don't realize it. And that sometimes you need that reminder that, like, you're doing all right. I heard a quote in a podcast the other day, which is not quite It's a Wonderful Life, but I think it's something that's important to you and myself to hear, which was the guest was saying, it's really difficult when you're a creative person because you have to balance feeling like a failure while simultaneously also being probably the most successful person that your friends and family know. And I was like, holy shit, did that like that's hit deep. Me in my core? Because yeah, I feel like I'm nowhere near where I want to be with my career. But as far as like the people I went to high school with or like anybody in my family, they've never met or seen anybody who's like traveling constantly and doing all these cool things in pursuit of their dreams. So in their eyes, I already am a success because I'm doing something that I love as a full-time career. And I feel like It's a Wonderful Life is one of those movies that really helps ground me and remind me that like the decisions that I'm making, and even if it feels like it's not going in a big way, if someone's life is made better by having interacted with me, then I'm living a good life, regardless on how successful I am. So
I love that. I just recently had an experience like that last week with my new job, which is a survival job. I've taken a step away from entertainment, which is a really hard pill for me to swallow. I'm like, am I letting myself down or whatever? But I had a moment like that where someone reached out and was just like, your conversation with me today made a difference in how I've thought about the last 2 years and me moving forward. And thank you. And I was just like, holy shit, this is what it's about. Like, and it is. I think we get so caught up in the production and success and status and all that. And it's not about that.
Yeah. And you're a wild case. Go and check out the 2-hour podcast that Gelsey did on the Alyssa Explains It All podcast. But like,
I'm not.
I think your situation is more trying to chase a giant success dragon that you had already, because I feel like by your mid-20s you had already succeeded in bigger ways than most people do in 70 years of living,
which is that's kind of a blessing and a curse. You hear a lot about when people, you know, achieve their dreams young, where do you go from there? And I thought next was Hollywood, and sometimes the reality of the day-to-day getting to a dream is not what you want, and that's kind of,
it's not sexy.
That's where I'm at, is just like, sure, the idea of the top of the mountain looks good, but the reality is the climb, and it's just being realistic. Is that the life you want to live? And I don't know if it is.
One of my favorite lyrics, a friend of mine wrote a song one time, and one of the lyrics they wrote was, I've got 5 more years of trying my best to become an overnight success. And I was like, what a, there's a lot of truth and sadness in that lyric.
Yeah, and it is. And it's like that, you know, well, did you know that this big famous actress lived under their car until they were 50? And look at them now. And I'm like, I don't want to live in my car until I'm 50.
I don't want to live in my car. That's the thing.
That
you have to hit
the thing. I don't know. Yeah, and that's the reality where I'm at. So
yeah. But you know what? We left a lot of great movies on the board, and after this commercial break, we'll go over a few of our honorable mentions.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It is mind-blowing.
And heartbreaking.
How many original scripts are written every year but are never made.
So we seek out these scripts and bring them to life with full audio production and professional actors.
Check us out at Undiscover Scripts.
Movies made of paper.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Free!
All right, Gelsey, we are back. And, I mean, I've probably got like 10 things in my honorable mentions. I'm not going to go over all of them, but how about you? What were some of, let's spitball a few of our honorable mentions.
Yeah, well, we already know Young Frankenstein is on both of ours, and I like that we both took it off for the right reason. But my other Bette Davis one is Jezebel. She's very young in that movie. It's amazing. It's great. Double Indemnity, which we've done an entire episode on that. I didn't say what number, but if you want to learn more about that film, that is my Barbara Stanwyck.
I don't know why, but in my brain, I want to say it was 44. I have no clue why.
I feel like that sounds right. Sure. You know what? I think it might be like 49 or 50.
It's in that general vicinity, though.
Stylistically, if I think of her hair. I don't know. Okay. You know me. Holiday Inn. You know how much I love that movie. I know.
I was actually shocked that Holiday Inn
wasn't.
Especially when you made a reference to it earlier. I was like, ooh, Holiday Inn could be in here.
I didn't go with, you know what? Holiday movies are never going to be on my top list. I love them during the holidays, but they're just not a, I don't know. And then my other Barbara Stanwyck movie that I love is The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. It's really a great film noir of like, I think you see her kill someone first, and that it's a great classic tangled love story and death. And she like ends up shooting him while she's like hugging him in the end and embrace. It's one of those like, oh,
yeah,
that one's great. Those are kind of actually, I just tried to spitball off the top of my head. There's so many. I mean, every single Fred and Ginger movie is my favorite. Roberta's great. Top Hat's amazing. Those all deserve a place. And then, you know, Marx Brothers, but those were the ones that I just kind of, pooped out.
Also, we could not have been further off. Double Indemnity was episode 18.
It was episode 18?
Episode 18.
Jesus.
I just looked it up. So similarly to why I kept Young Frankenstein off the list of being like, this was well after black and white movies had kind of faded out.
Uh-huh.
So I also did that for Night of the Living Dead. From 1968.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, the original black and white Night of the Living Dead is arguably one of the best horror films ever made.
Yes.
I'm going to only do ones that we hadn't mentioned. Obviously, Some Like It Hot was on my honorable mentions list because the movie's great. Harvey, which I've referenced before, is a Jimmy Stewart film that I absolutely love. It's, you know, about a giant imaginary rabbit, which... part of the reason why I wanted to see it was just because of the weird reference that's made about it in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. When he goes, oh, you know, I'll show you my rabbit, Harvey. And then, I mean, it's considered one of the most important films of all time. I would say, well, it's not my favorite movie of all time. It is probably the most important movie ever made, which is obviously Citizen Kane, like the things that movie did for like the filmmaking process. And then a movie that I'd love for us to just do an episode where we dive into it one day.
Dead Men,
Sullivan's Travels.
Oh, just kidding.
Have you ever seen Sullivan's Travels?
Mm-mm.
So it's kind of an obscure movie. Like it's one that shows up on a lot of like best of lists. Veronica Lake, Joel McCrea. And it's about a filmmaker named Sullivan. He's a director who decides that he's going to live life as a homeless person so that he can make a gritty, real drama about what people go through when being homeless. And what ends up happening is he learns the importance of comedy. And there's a great speech that he gives towards the end of the movie where he says, there's a lot to be said about making people laugh. Do you know that for some people, that's all that they have? And it isn't much, but it's better than nothing in this cockamamie cavern of life. And I feel like that movie delivers so much of a message of what you and I both kind of believe, which is like, comedy is so important for bringing people out of the darkness, and that it is a very valuable thing. Yeah. So those would be my honorable mentions. They almost made it. They were this close. My God, my hair. Kelsey, if there are other films that people think, how could you not include this five-star Roger Ebert's favorite black and white movie pick? Where can they go and let us know what we missed?
Like the Steve Martin Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid? That's what I was saying.
We have to do Dead Men.
We have to do. I know. That was another one. I was like, I can't. But that's we've talked about doing a deep dive and then going through each movie that is incorporated in that. But yes, you can let us know what your favorite black and white movie and how stupid we are for not including it on Instagram. Find us at beforemytime_podcast or on Facebook. Just type in Before My Time. We will pop up right on our wall. Send us a DM. Comment on our latest post. Even if it has nothing to do with black and white movies, just be like, what's up? And I'll be like, hey, what's up? Also, if you have a second, please leave us a review. 5 stars would be awesome. It helps us get in front of more listeners like yourself. Thanks again so much for tuning in, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.